Hi, I'm Madonna Guy, and you're watching the Natural Alternative Podcast. Welcome. I'm here today with David Shield, counsellor. I'm honoured to have you on the show. Welcome, David.
Oh, thanks, Madonna. How are you today?
I'm really well. Some of the things that we discussed a little bit about in our last one that I wanted to delve more into, there were words that you were using that I know are now being, they're buzzwords out there, parts work and people's agency and what it means. Self-efficacy and self-control. So you've done quite a bit of research and work with people in this. So let's talk about agency, absolutely, because every time we do have these discussions behind closed doors, I know it's something that's really important that people need to understand.
Right. So agency is basically our ability to have a goal-related effect in the world. And so someone with strong agency, when they go in out, they can affect their goals, they can actually make an influence what happens in the world for themselves, and which is a very positive thing once you get that in harness.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the original work on agency was done by, like, Albert Bandura. He was a Canadian. And so, and agency has been, the work I was doing was particularly with drug addiction and agency. And so where that was coming about was there was a relationship between agency and self-control. And so people who, and the types of self-control, so self-control, Bandura did like five or six types, but in this there's three types that are focused on. And the first one is intentional agency. An intentional agency means that I'm someone who'll do what I say, I am what I am, I'm authentic, and I kind of follow through with what I say I'll do. That's intentional agency.
That's the one I would like to be.
Intentional self-control. Yeah.
Yes.
And once that's harnessed, it becomes intentional agency. And the second one is called instrumental self-control. And that means that basically you think in life in terms of progressive goals and that you achieve them one after another as you go through life's different stages.
Right.
So you hit a goal and then, and so that agency, because that grows over time, from this goal, the next one's achieved and like that. And the third type of agency, which is apparently the least understood, is called normative agency. And that means when we're living life according to our ideals and values, and whatever our idea of what a good life is. And what's interesting about the third one is that that one's motivational.
Right.
So a lot of work with addiction is working on, you know, self-control on one level or another, but using people's own values and idea of a good life to motivate them is something that I found very interesting. So if someone's addicted to drugs, say, example might be that they might see, according to their values, they're spending too much money and making their family not do as well.
Yes.
And so getting to those motivational factors in their present values, or they might have had a life where they need to build new types of values. So they might build a new architecture for working out those three phases of life.
Because in the last few years, it's been mentioned that people's agency has been halted, or,
you know, is that right?
Yeah, because goal setting's been challenging when you don't know what the planet's going to be doing.
Because of the pandemic?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes. So all of those three things are affected by that.
Yes.
And so obviously that people can't do what they couldn't do what they planned to do because they were stopped.
Yes.
And whether, and from most people's perspective, that was valid, you know, and some people have some difficulties, but basically that's true. People weren't able to be authentic and completely because they were restricted, and people definitely weren't able to achieve their goals, and that would have been also apparent with kids at school. And then, and also people's idea of a good life was completely affected because a lot of the things that they did to make them feel happy, they just couldn't do.
Yes.
And so all the studies show that now post-pandemic and post-lockdown, there's a lot of detriments to Actually, most people, depending on how resilient people are, but some people are, their baseline stress levels just start up here when they walk out the door. So people are less regulated.
Yes. Yeah. I saw a study that 125,000 Aussie kids are now addicted to online gaming. Right. And that it's creating all of the issues associated with addictions in adults.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything from the anger and tantrums and, you know.
And that'd be more with teenagers.
It is mostly with teenagers, but a lot of kids. I had a four-year-old in, maybe he was five last week, who's he is on online gaming platforms.
Sure.
But with parents' supervision, but nonetheless, it's very interesting that kids are getting into these things so young.
Yeah. Most of the work I did was on adolescents.
Yes.
I kind of avoided the little kids because but with adolescents, so in the same context with self-control and roles particularly. So I was studying one theorist called, I'm not sure how you say her name, but Anke Snoke, and she's a Dutch theorist. And so she was doing work with addiction and roles. And she had an interesting part. It was in her PhD study, and it was about teenagers. And so what happens when teenagers become addicted to anything? For a start, the neurobiology of the brain isn't able to handle that, so it's likely they'll become very addicted very quickly. But one of the main problems is they don't experience enough roles, life roles. Because
right.
in teenage life, there's a few things going on there. They get a double dopamine hit for novelty, so anything new. So as a parent, you can kind of steer them with new things.
Yes.
And therefore they get to experience a whole bunch of different, you know, different things in life. Because when you go out there, just say you're playing a sport, you've got a whole bunch of mentors out there to integrate. And when you do a lot of things as a teenager, you can integrate a lot of different personality types and ways of being. Whereas when you are addicted to something, whether it's, and some, unfortunately, some kids get addicted to drugs as well, but the internet has the same thing, that it's actually restricting the experience, the breadth of experiences that teenagers are able to have, which they need, because adolescence goes till 25, because that's when the prefrontal cortex finishes growing,
yeah.
The whole top of the brain. And so if that time they become addicted to things, they get pulled into what's called a local environment where things are just day-to-day, and those goals, those progressive goals aren't there, and it leads to like people without the self-agency, self-control, that leads to depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
And so by bringing them aligned, back in a line where people can get their self-control and therefore their self-efficacy back, which is a sort of motor of agency, then they're able to, it realigns so that they can get those things back in order.
So how do you get adolescents out of the bedroom on the computer and back into life? Is it just parents taking a much more active role, forcing them to do things? Because teenagers can be pretty belligerent, and especially when there's an addiction there. Like these yes. are true addictions,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, that they're going through.
Well, you know, there's another thing going on with that too, that it's convenient to have the kids on the screens,
yeah,
which is what everyone calls them, but and that happened in the pandemic out of necessity, because people had to work at home and school their kids.
Yes.
And that's actually impossible. And so, yeah. You know, doing two priority tasks at once. But Dan Siegel says that you can, if you realise that they get a double dopamine hit from novelty, you can sort of steer them with finding new interesting things to do. And parents can equip them, well, maybe this, you know, and they'll say no a lot, but if you make them good, they'll do it.
Yeah.
Like, because teenagers just want to fill in the day, right? Because, you know, addicts get into this localized perspective, right? But teenagers are in that already.
Right.
So they're just trying, they're living day to day. They just want to have every day interesting and fill it in. And so they're doing that with the internet. And but it just gets too much. And if you recognize that it's what's happening, it's a shortage of roles, it's the parents' job to actually give their kids enough opportunities so that they can experience many roles in life.
Okay, so some people might be wondering what you're talking about when you're talking about the roles.
Mm-hmm.
So let's delve a little bit more into that.
Okay.
Obviously, from your perspective, you're a parent, you're a husband, you're a father, you're a brother, you're a son, you're a, you know, you're a mentor, you're a counselor. Mm-hmm. So from a teenage perspective, where do they sort of go with that?
Well, the problem with roles is that even with adults, okay, so just say, because roles is my specialty, which is an identity service working on people's roles.
Yes.
And what happens is roles exist in a hierarchy. So if one role is taking over the others, like which might be an addiction.
Yeah.
In the present case, or a computer addiction, but also the modern ideas on addiction is there can be anything obsessive. So it might be working too much or only spending time on, like often with parents, parenting and work can take over their whole life. And so a lot of roles that make them happy, they just don't do.
Yeah.
Right. And that's kind of a form of neglect. Right.
Except
it's because we're neglecting things that make us feel good. And then we're not feeling good, and then we might get depression, anxiety, and then we take it on our partner or even blame them or blame the kids. You know, you're stressing me out, but I'm stressed out because I'm not living a full, authentic life.
Right.
And so with roles, because there's no blame with it, it's the way we didn't get education on a lot of things when we grew up, so many people. So the first step is differentiating the roles. So actually, developing a self-awareness of all the roles that we do in our lives and dividing them up. And so my process is to assess them. So you'll have, I work on a body, mind, heart, soul principle, which is social life, vocational life and education, home life, and then spiritual or values and ideals. And so within all of those sections, you have different roles come off them naturally. Like in social roles, there'll be citizenship roles, like having a license and all things like that. And, you know, maintaining good friendships, having a social life, all the things that produce social positive hormones, like dopamine and oxytocin from relationships, yeah, and all the other hormones that go with that. But also then in vocational, making sure that, yeah, we'll educate ourselves progressively to get the best we can or what suits us, but also educating ourselves in other things too, like hobbies and that sort of thing. And over that side, there's a series of mentors that we collect. You know what I mean? Mentors, and that's how we progress, because, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And then the other side is the home roles. Home roles, everything comes from home. So at home is where we'll do all the self-work. And also we'll have family there, and it's our private space where people come to that setting, and all good things start at home. And then the values and spiritual roles, they're all about self-care, what we do to regenerate and rejuvenate. It might be going out to nature. Everybody's got a set of, and the values that we live according to, you know, making sure that we have those things in place, like being a good person, it might be, or, you know, and the values that actually they regulate the others to make us, you know, legal, ethical, moral, and with self-control at the top. And self-control has found to be, like the Dunedin study in New Zealand, they found self-control was the marker that really made the difference between well-being in every aspect of life. And the people without self-control were, they didn't do as well and they used that. There's an amazing graph showing it. And with that, and recently, last year and the year before, there were studies on, they said if you get self-control later in life, they suggested that it would make you live longer. So it's reversing getting self-control later in life can even reverse some of the things that have caused us to be out of balance in our early life.
Right. So with self-control later on in life, is that just people coming into awareness or coming into the right space in their life where they've got time to think about what they've been doing? Sometimes people are just living. They're just living. They're not even thinking about.
That's right.
And that, or their.
And that's why I worked on a role system, because it's the easiest way to actually work all this stuff out, because it's easy to go through those things and go, so I'm just worn out. And so people need support with it. So I've made a system where they can get those roles just in a word, IMA. You know what I mean? So in socially, like I said, I'm a good driver. It might be I'm a good friend. You know what I mean? I'm a good social, but they're all the things we do out in the world. It might be a sport or something. And then in the vocational area, like I might be, like in my case, I'm a counsellor, but I used to be a designer. But I keep those skills up and combine them, and all that education that you do in your life, you can, it all contributes to your overall outcome. And then a series of roles is over there, and then home roles, do you know what I mean? Like you're a, I'm a husband, I'm a dad, I'm a, you know, I'm a cook and a gardener. There's all these things that happen in the whole. And then spiritually, I'm a serious meditator. I do a variety of types of meditation, breath work, that type of thing, and always developing new values to make sure that I can integrate more and more with my values. Because when we've got a deficit role, it's, you know, you can work, it's like a chink in your values.
I mean, if so you've a deficit got a role, like if you drink too much or something like that.
Yeah, like we talked about an addiction, it's a deficit role.
Okay.
But you can work with those roles. So narrative therapy has these things where you externalize. And so what you do is you externalize the role. So I'm an addicted person, because you write out an IMA, I'm an addicted person. And then you look at that and you go, well, how has that affected myself and my relationships? And the other side is, how have I contributed to it? And that's where you start being able to tweak it.
Yeah.
Because you see your part in it and how it affects. And then you start to like see it more clearly. And all problem roles, you can work using that externalizing formula, which it takes it away from the person. It's like over there now, because I'm a person with an addiction problem. I'm not an addict.
Yes. Yes. And that's one of the problems, isn't it? Because I have the same thing when people come in here with, say, fibromyalgia or chronic pain or chronic fatigue, and they say, Hashimoto's or whatever. And, you know, sometimes I have to say to them, you are not your chronic fatigue. You are not your Hashimoto's. You are so much more than this. You know, like people literally get themselves into a box and they can't think outside of that, which is so limiting.
And those boxes can be addictions, they can be overwork, they could be switching off. And so what the role work does, first step's differentiation. So you just pull them all out, each role, and you've got this nice list of, you know, I'm there, all these people you are, and you've like might forget about them. And to have them all out there to be able to work on them is really nice. And then each role you can take it and you can measure it. So just say, What's an idea of a role for you? Like,
oh, well, let's just say the guitar thing. I'd love to be able to play guitar, but, you know, when I pick it up once every month and my fingers get sore and I don't pick it up again, I'm not going to become a good guitar player. So,
right.
So I'm currently a 1 out of 10.
Oh, you're a 1 out of 10. Yeah, so you measure them from 1 to 10. And 5 means that you're competent.
Do you know
what
I mean? You can
actually. Right, well, so you're down here a little bit. Well, then it comes to the point, do you want to be a good guitar player? Because the other thing is that when you sit in a role and you think about an ideal,
yes,
like being a good guitar player, say, you don't have to be great, good, competent, whichever your goal is, because you don't have to be great everything. You might just want to sing some songs to be that good. And so then, so just say that's 5 to be a good one. You go sit in that role. How does it feel thinking about you being a 5 guitar player?
Yeah, that'd be great.
And so that's motivational, because immediately there's, if I get a role and I'm currently, you know, a 3 or a 6, just say I'm a 6 and I want to be a 9, there's a gap there. But if I imagine myself 9, that feels nice. You're already starting to move towards the new self.
Yes.
Towards the new thing. And that positive future orientated thinking is the basis of the instrumental goal, that you progressively achieve goals. And by laying out all your roles in one place, you've now got a little map of all these different characters that you play. And they're all parts of ourselves and they're all verbs, like they're all stories, because a story is a verb, like rather than a noun. So, and then you add to that narrative agency.
Right.
Which is getting into the stories of these roles. All these roles have a history. Like, I bet if you look at you as a guitar player, I bet there's a history there.
Yeah, like 30 years ago. I could
Right,
play.
Okay.
Right, and I actually did hop up on stage a few times in a band when I was living in Cooktown.
Right.
So, playing bass guitar, actually.
Right. So Madonna, the guitar player, has got a story. And so you're looking at it, but you can't quite get motivated to do the practice yet.
Yeah.
But by just talking about it, talking about that person, Madonna, the guitar player, that gives it life.
Yeah.
Because essentially, we're stories. Our life is a story. And each of these are like little sub-roles and sub-characters that each have their own story that all add together to our whole story.
Mm.
And the other nice thing about that is that when you get all those parts, it makes it really nice talking to other people, because you're actually focusing on these things. You actually become really self-aware of the different parts of you that operate and make you like, because they've all got their own stories. And when you're aware of them, I've been doing this, I've been doing that. They're all positive, wholesome things.
Right. So this is not the same as people's values, is it? This is quite a different thing to, like people might have values of, freedom or body sovereignty or connection with family or, this is quite separate from that? Or
no, not at all. No, they're roles.
Oh, those are all roles.
Yeah, so you put them as, so instead it doesn't have to be an object. So I am a caring person.
Yes.
Right, and you can measure that. Like for example, before I went to, I've just finished in graduate diploma in counselling. Before I did that, I could say that I didn't understand a lot of things, like, for example, being an empathetic person. I had an idea about that was, but I didn't understand how to do it. And then you actually go through a process of looking at that role as and David, the empathetic person. And when you're honest, I might have been a 3, but I was able to really move that up through having mentors who are actually empathetic and teach you how to do it, because there's some theory behind that too.
Right. So, and once again, that's different from being an empath, which is something that I, in my line of work, I have many clients who are empaths.
Because there's negative sides to empathy.
Right.
So there was a landmark study done by Sarah Conrath and Delphine Greinberg, looking at the positive and negative sides of empathy. And when you look at the negative side, they're really interesting what you're surprised at seeing. Like it might be, for example, a bias where they might be a heart transplant thing, but I'm biased towards this client, so I'll push them up the list.
Right.
Or I'm biased towards my group, so I'll argue really, fully so that my group gets the funding and the others don't, who need it more maybe. Or then there's also identifying with bad actors, right? Especially cognitively, the study shows that you'll become like them. You'll take on their, like people who are non-consensual, like the study looks at, people who are rapists and that, and they looked at how the different genders look at them according, and there was that fairness, and they worked out that the cognitive empathetic part, if you identify with the people who are immoral, you actually start to think like them, and it disorientates your feeling empathy, apparently. That's what it said. And I thought that was incredible. And so, but then true empathy, which is, really feeling the suffering of others and trying to help, and that engagement in that, and, that's always positive. And, but there's these negative things that come in controlling behaviour too. There's kind of like you might empathise with someone, even as a counsellor, you might be empathising with someone but you're kind of experimenting and you want to see what the outcome is, and you're not really thinking about them, you're thinking about what you want to do.
Right.
That's not empathetic.
That's a bit cheeky.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, my brain was going into Hollywood there for a second. So, you know, Hollywood can shape the way that people think. So if it's the intention of Hollywood to make people more empathetic towards violence, they might put shows on TV like Dexter and Sopranos, where, you know, I love Dexter, I love Tony Soprano. And you sort of think, what does that say about me liking someone who's a mass murderer? You know, and you sort of think about how we're framed, you know, our thoughts are framed by what we see and what we feel. And when we watch things that have a certain thought, like they're pushing an, well, I don't know if they're pushing an agenda or just having fun, but you know what I mean? It's sort of like, it is interesting. The brain doesn't know what's real or imaginary. So when we are watching things and even thinking things that aren't true, you know, if you're just in your brain all the time and you're having a bad day and you're telling yourself you're a bad person, this is just all stuff that's truth in your brain because we're saying it to ourselves. So, sorry, I had a thought there. It's sort of about, you know, you mentioned the bad actors before, and I know that's not what you were meaning when you said that. But it's,
they use the word bad actors in the article.
Yeah.
And so that's, I mean, you know, they're things to be careful. That's an ethical thing too, because most sides of empathy are really good. Like, first, there's the compassion side, and the whole, you know, part of being a healer is, you know, caring for people and trying to get them to a better place. But there's also the other side of sharing joy with others.
Yeah,
you know, that's a part of positive part of empathy too. And in most cases, it's positive. But studies came out that just showed that empathy wasn't always a good thing.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I hadn't actually thought about empathy, you know, towards something that's not wholesome as being a bad thing, I suppose. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, but, you know, there's whether you get influenced or not will depend on how many, so that you could call those things risk factors.
Yes.
But depending on how many protective factors you have, like, you won't go there.
Right.
Like if you developed really strong values in being a compassionate, kind person, things like that won't affect you as much as somebody who's dysregulated, and they see it and they might want to, like, copycat.
Yeah.
Because copycat's a big thing, you know, that people copy. Which is another thing about the internet addiction. So there's a lot of self-harming is copycat behaviour.
Yeah.
And there's
whole forums on the best ways to do it without damaging too much and all sorts of things like that.
Right, yeah. But in the meta studies, they find that, yes, that's true, that people do copycat behaviour, and also suicide's copycattish. But the original studies they found in that were, they noticed that people in psychiatric hospitals, if one more person was self-harming, the person in the next room would start doing it, and it was like they weren't even seeing each other. And so there seems to be the strange copycat contagion is very strange. But they found in the meta studies that even though the internet is doing those negative things, actually people are also reaching out on the internet and seeking help and talking to people about it, which is a positive thing.
Right.
So they're not, and with everything, there's a negative story, but there's also protective factors. So there you've got the risks of being exposed to those things. Because don't forget, people who are self-harming, they're like there's a couple of things about that. Like, they're reenacting the experience. They were harmed by someone, now they're harming themselves. And also it's a numbing thing. It's like they do things, people with really sad types of trauma, they're doing things, they become numb and they do crazy things to make them feel alive. And that's the last word, you know, they feel. And so one is acting out on, I've been hurt, so I'll hurt myself. And the other side is that they're numb, and so they'll do daredevil activity, really risky behaviour to just feel alive because they've been deadened by these.
Yeah.
Some people are terrible.
Yeah, I heard someone the other day say it was like, the emotional pain was so big inside they wanted to cut themselves so that the physical trauma would take away from the emotional pain for a short amount of time.
And that's what's going on. And And funnily enough, it's not only trauma, but it's also loss and grief.
Yeah.
And also neglect too. That's the one everybody forgets about. And yeah. then the young people going through, their teenager going through, I mean, that's already hard and it becomes even more complicated.
Yeah. I remember when I was in grade 10, I think at school, and we had this girl who was over from the States, and she was like a, you know, when they come from another country and they come to the school anyway. And I remember her saying that it was her job at home to cook the family meal because her parents just work. Mm. But when she was, and she was actually in my home economics class where we learned all sorts of recipes and things, but she'd never done anything from scratch before. So everything that she'd done in the home was all about can this or prepackage that. Or so even though she was the cook in the family, it still wasn't really cooking. It was very much convenient. Oh, there was no training whatsoever. And she was the cook for the family. And, you know, you sort of take that one little example of neglect, and obviously her parents needed to be working, surely, otherwise they wouldn't have been doing it. But you sort of do wonder at what point we have to take that responsibility back and say, okay, we need to, yeah. What did you mention that some people...
Well, that actually is called parentification, when you get the kids to do parents' jobs that right. are more, that are beyond, that means that they can't do their own jobs.
And is that a form of neglect or trauma or...
Yeah, it's like a, it's something. There's a lot of studies on it. But,
yeah.
But you know, it depends on whether, depends on how bad it is. I mean, it's good to get the kids to take responsibility for things and take over roles. So it's not that. And that might have been like that. Every case is different and every circumstance is different. And so even though there might be some risk factors, you know, like some neglect or some mild, you know, pets, there might be so many protective factors that the kids are really resilient.
Yeah.
Because in different cases, some people will be extremely badly abused and they heal themselves and they come out okay. And other people, you know, like one, you mentioned Bessel van der Kolk earlier, it's like he says it's an, he says the point that it's amazing in a psychiatric hospital that you've got two people in rooms next to each other with the same symptoms, and one was horrifically abused as a child and the other one's got an issue with one of their siblings.
Yeah, right.
But they've got the same symptoms.
There was a study, you've heard of the telomeres. Have you heard of telomeres? You know, with our little DNA strands, there's these things on the end of our DNA strands called telomeres. They're like the plastic on the end of shoelaces. You know,
I haven't gone into that deep. Right.
No, that's cool. But this is just sort of interesting on perception of stress. So the shorter they get, the less protected our genes are. We can activate dodgy genes that we're not supposed to activate. You know, so basically there's some magical middle ground that makes us nice and healthy and our genes are protected.
Mm-hmm.
We know that trauma can affect our genes negatively. So what this study was looking at was the children of, it was the children who had chronic illness, and they were looking at the telomeres in the parents to see whether the parents' telomeres were broken and damaged.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was something really cool, which it had nothing to do with the health of the parent, nothing to do with the health of the child. It had to do with the perception of the amount of trauma the child was going through and the prognosis they believed that the child had.
What are those two things in layman terms?
So the parents' telomeres were shorter when they believed their child was going to die or not have a good prognosis. Those parents who believed that their child, even though they had really chronic illness, the parents who believed there was going to have a good outcome had longer telomeres. So the power of the mind absolutely protects our DNA and our telomeres and helps to protect us from DNA damage from trauma.
Well, isn't that interesting? And isn't that similar to hope?
Absolutely. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Totally. Okay.
Well, there's been some really nice studies on how that works. So you're saying the parents who like assumed a positive outcome?
Yes. They had longer telomeres, so therefore they were protecting their DNA and their genes.
And did the kids have better outcomes?
Oh, that wasn't part of the study, actually.
Oh, what was the study again?
Oh, it was Elizabeth Blackburn, I think, is the lady's name. It was about, 10, 15 years ago. it was really basically about to see whether chronically ill kids came from people with damaged telomeres. Like, that's what the study was in,
right,
and they're supposed to be, but that's not what they found in the least.
They found that the more resilient parents, or the more hopeful parents, they performed well, because a lot of those parents end up with burnout.
Yes. The ones with hope?
No, the ones with disabled kids.
Yeah.
No, generally, parents with, you know, chronically damaged kids, they can burn out because it's such hard work.
Yeah, and same with the marriages, don't tend to do that great either.
Marriages, right.
The marriages of chronically ill kids.
Well, hope. So in therapy, they found that hope, if the therapist's hope can make up for the client's lack of hope in a difficult time.
Right.
So they found that there's like hope in the client. I can't remember quite the order, but it's like if a therapist has hope that that they'll be able to heal themselves, they'll be able to go through the process and do well. And then that's basically believing in the client's ability to heal. And then there's hope in the client, which is really similar, but that's holding hope for the client while they're in the difficult time. So you hold it for them.
Right.
And they say that the therapist's hope, if a therapist has hope in the person, that is more effective than the client's own hope. Because people with depression feel hopeless. So then there's hope with the client, which is all the person-centered, empathetic, all the Carl Rogers stuff. That's the first one. And the second stuff, hope in the client, is holding hope for the client, like, and which is the basic function of a safe base in attachment theory. So you're being a safe base for them, because what's a safe base? When the child's stressed, they come to you for soothing. Yeah. So you act out that for the client while they're going through their changes and holding hope for them. And then there's hope in the process. So that's hope in our therapeutic process, that we have the tools to actually pull this off and get the client to the other side of the transformation. And then the last one's hope in nature, in the rejuvenation of life, in that this too shall pass, and we'll go to a new place, we'll evolve just from, because Jung said sometimes the most difficult problems in life, we mightn't be able to resolve them, but we can at least grow out of them when the next thing comes and makes us forget about that.
Yeah.
Like, for example, hasn't the Ukrainian war made everyone forget about the pandemic?
I think that was the plan.
Right, well, whatever. But, you know, it's like that the next big thing comes and all of a sudden the urgency goes away from the last problem. And you can see that in people's lives. People with problems, a good or a bad thing will happen, and all of a sudden they're back on a new path, or the problem they had, they're the worst problem now, or the problem they had, things have picked up and now they're like just feeling better and moving along.
Yeah. Oh, no, what I meant is the mainstream media just likes us focusing on fear, you know. It just keeps on pushing us there. Yeah,
they've always been at that.
It's always been a bit of a shenanigan basket. Young news. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So, and the studies with hope. So do people eventually get that hope back for themselves? If they're in a total place of despair and dysregulation and their life has never given them anything but thorns, like, what's the process of getting someone's hope back? Is it working with their roles? Is it?
It depends on each client, because everybody's got a different formula and everyone's got a different history. And so, you know, studying family therapy particularly, you know, like apart from individual therapy, it's all systems orientated. So you can look at the whole developmental history. You can look at all the way they've formed relationships in their sibling and family groups. And because so many ways that we are, which cause difficulties in the future, are the patterns we set in our childhood.
Yeah.
And they're hard to move around, but you can move them around if with family therapy, there's a lot of skill training, because I know from my own experience that you end up married and you end up with kids and it's really stressful.
Yeah.
And so my thing was, I did family counselling And it was fantastic because there's so many things you can improve that you don't even know about. Because like everything, we didn't get that great a training when we were growing up.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? In relationships, you know, we kind of just learned it off the people around us. And depending whether we had good people or not, we learned better or not better.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember a couple that I hung around a bit when I was about 18 or 19. And I remembered a few of the things that they just had this entirely different worldview to my parents. They had this entirely different, you know, they were, they just had a really neat relationship. It was just bizarre. It was bizarre to see a relationship that wasn't the same as my parents. And they were fun and they were happy and they just, it was very interesting to see.
Right. Well, they were like that when they had visitors anyway.
Yeah, no, I think they were just a very different humans. Well, maybe.
I experienced that as a kid. But then, so in the theory, what do they call that? So in family systems, Murray Bowen said that people are more differentiated, he called it, and people who are differentiated, their relationships are interdependent.
Right.
They don't have like what you call codependent before, which that's called fused. He calls that fused, and fused relationships are really emotional and it's hard to regulate them. They might be conflictive. And then other things that happen in families, you say triangles, so there's like allegiances, groups fight against each other.
Yeah. You know
what I mean, two against one, or even one to regulate the other two. Parents will fight, but the kids there to keep a balance. Different types. And the other thing is cutoffs, right? And so, but cutoffs and fusions, they're the two sides of dysregulation, like because cutoffs are like rigidity.
Yes.
And dysregulation is chaos. Do you know what I mean? Too much emotion. And so the idea was to be in the middle, and he called that differentiation, is that you actually have a differentiated relationship between you and your siblings, and there's a lot less emotion in that. And so a lot of families have just got that from their generations. Do you know what I mean? And so, and that differentiated position is, you know, rare in society, like completely. That's what the way he put it. But an interesting thing is that differentiated position, they found that hopeful people are differentiated people. So highly differentiated people are highly hopeful. And what they found in the theory was that they didn't do wishful thinking. When they had a problem, they actually worked out how to solve it.
Right, rather than being codependent on someone else to help them work it out.
Yeah, and so the reason that they're hopeful is because they got used to that. So in crisis, they're able to separate themselves, not be fused, and just go, right, this approach. And so those people make good counsellors too, because they can help people differentiate themselves.
Yeah, 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 I am not my disease.
No, and
not
then
parents.
No, yeah. But then differentiation is the first step in integration theory, right? So in integration theory, it's like differentiation, recoordination, and then integration. So in counselling, you're trying to help people, you know, in a number of ways, maybe change a way of thinking or make their story different or better. Or so, and moving from A to B, there's a middle part where it all moves round. And so with role work, what you're doing is you're differentiating the roles, right? So they're all becoming separate instead of just our blob of our identity. And now they're all out there. You look at them all and you look at their value. And you look at their current hierarchy, and then you go, right, I don't like doing this all the time, whether it's addiction or working too hard. And you go, I want to do some of these because these make me feel happy about myself. And they might be, you know, playing music in your case, or finding a new form of meditation or self-care so that you can get calm again. And so when you differentiate the roles, then you redo the hierarchy so that, okay, these ones are in now. So in my list of jobs to do becomes a list of roles to do. I'm not feeling good. I haven't played guitar for a while. I'm not feeling good. In my case, I need to do some painting. I'm not feeling good. I need to start breathing and then start thinking properly. And because the integration process, like that's so differentiation, redoing the hierarchy, and then reintegrating with the new hierarchy in place. So our list list to do becomes roles that we want to do throughout the day or the week, and we make sure we get those in, and then we start to become aware of our unique complexity.
Yeah.
Because even if two people are very similar, right, because they're best friends and they're all in the same groups, when you work out their roles, they can be quite different.
Yeah.
I'm sure that'd work with twins too, but
well, I was thinking with people's what did I say before, their hierarchy of needs, you know, their hierarchy of beliefs. In the same way, you know, that could be why people are doing, you know, both people coming from music, but they might come from it from two totally different perspectives.
Sure.
You know, yeah.
And a key part of getting roles going is looking for mentors.
Right.
Right. And it's, and part of our gratitude in life is being grateful for the mentors who did teach us. And when you're integrating attachment, the idea is that you should think that my parents did the best they could under difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
And then even more important, and so did I, or so did you. Right, because, and Dan Siegel says that, he goes, it has to start there, which is like it's a recognition.
Yeah.
A recognition, because things like parenting are really hard. And so assuming people have done the best, I suppose, unless it's hard to tell in really terrible cases, some terrible things happen to people too, and I think they're set aside, but in a general sense, you consider it like that.
Yeah. Because, my brain goes to the whole narcissist, you know, phenomenon out there these days.
Well, it's something people are saying.
Yeah.
Except what people are calling narcissism, the percentage of clinical narcissists is going to stay very small, say 1 or 2% in Western countries. But there is an increase. Studies, the same people who did the empathy study, they are finding that narcissistic traits are increasing.
Right.
And more of a emphasis with power and control than those ways of caring for people, and that, you know, that social bond there used to be there.
Yeah.
Those things.
Do they know why that is? Do they know why it's increasing? Because even if I think about one of the studies from about 30 years ago, they did it on prisoners in jail.
Right.
And all they did was give them like a multivitamin a day. It was something really basic. And the amount of fights went down because people didn't have the basic nutrition for brain integration. Mm-hmm. So when their brains integrated a fraction better by having some, you know, B vitamins and stuff in their nervous systems, you know, and I can't remember, but it was like 20% less. It was something fairly decent, you know, in an area where you've got to have huge amount of, you know, trauma and neglect and pain and self-abuse going on.
But that's what they find in, they find it demographically with all the types of child abuse that, you know, because it's a real spectrum with that. Some people are just not getting on at a time in their lives and they fix it, but the risk factors, surprisingly, a lot of them have to do with demographics. Do you know what I mean? Like with drugs, it's availability. You're a teenager, do you live in a suburb where you can get that easily?
Yeah.
And crime. And so a demographic being, I was surprised at how much of a component that was. And so it's like, and what that does, if you're counselling, you can see that it's less of the people's fault. Like a generational pattern coming through, that's not the kid's fault.
Yeah.
A dysregulated kid who is abused, that's not their fault.
Yeah.
You live in an area where there's a lot of violence and you have to become a fighter to survive. That's kind of not their fault.
Yeah.
And then the genetic thing, and then the family heritability. And when it comes down to it, like you said, the demographic actually is really quite a part of the risk factor. And also people with more money, they can make more protective factors like better nutrition, better education, you know, you might get help with the family. And so, you know, it's a sad thing, but the demographics of the how regulated your suburb is even can have an effect on how regulated people can be.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're risk factors for types of abuse, including neglect.
Yes. And I was even thinking even things like power poles and stuff like that. There's so many external factors that we have no control over.
Right. And then so the goal then, I mean, a lot of the stuff moving in the literature then is therefore mainly more focused on producing resilience in people and ways that they can become stronger in an environment that has more risk factors.
Yeah.
Because like they say, the people in those areas too, the resilient people do really well.
Yes.
You know, so, and like even in abused families, say, like where there's abuse, where there'll be some physical violence, or it's like some kids are affected and some aren't. Like maybe one third are and two third aren't. I think it's something like that. Or maybe it's, right. I can't remember the rate. They depend on different studies.
Yeah. Yeah, because I certainly see that with my clients. You can have, let's talk about rape for a sec. You might have some people who have been raped and it affects them for the rest of their life and they never get over it and they are just traumatized and anxious, whereas other people like, okay, I was raped, let's move on. Mm. You know, and even though they might be suppressing it, they might have just got on with it because, you know,
right.
At the time when you know, what could you do? What could you do?
Yeah. And there's so many
Diggory was older. I was, you know, not me, but, you know, I'm just saying, you know, I hear these stories so regularly from people. And then they blame themselves and go, you were 13. He was 10 years older than you. What are you supposed to do? You know? Yeah. Yeah, people blame themselves for so much moving forwards. And like you say, how much of this is not the child's fault?
Yeah, well, that's right.
If a child's brain is dysregulated because of too much sugar, it's not their fault. If a child's brain is dysregulated because they're seeing parents fighting all the time, it's not their fault. If they're being picked on by a teacher, it's not their fault.
Yeah, and because of that, I think I always think that innocence is just under the surface.
Yeah.
Because so many things aren't people's fault and they just learned badly and they've had effects that have made them negative. Because the other sad thing is that people who, you know, with the adverse childhood experiences in different categories, people who have those experiences, they're not only like to be re-victimised, but also they're more likely to hurt others.
Right.
To harm others because they're dysregulated. And so the current movement at the moment is try to get everybody, you know, educate everyone well about, because in the last 20 years they've just learnt this. And, you know, like when I grew up in the 70s, no, because I even talked to mum about it, and she goes, well, we didn't know anything in the 70s. And so they've worked this stuff out recently, and so it's a good opportunity to try to re-educate on so many areas on how to do it better.
Yeah, and it's probably, you know, when you did grow up in the 70s and 80s and the parents didn't know about this stuff, then it's probably luck. You know, what sports were you involved with and who were your mentors at, or were they more of the abuse?
What values that you got out of your family environment, and
you know, the scouts or the girl guides, or you know,
the local, really good things.
Yeah, all of the
in most cases,
you know, because those places can attract people who want to abuse kids as well. Sometimes.
Wherever kids are,
so the parents really need to be involved. It's just recently. Right. You know, I've got my grandbaby, Teddy, and we've got him involved in something called Mini Muscles, which is a little, you know, it's sort of a get-together for kids 4 to 12-year-olds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week, however people want to go. And already we can see a difference with his energy and his confidence.
Right. Yeah, so, because what are they? Social bonds. The other thing is social bonds are really important too.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people get isolated when they get sick or depressed. And so re-establishing social bonds is, they found, to be one of the most important things.
And so many single kids out there, so they're not going to have all that connection with brothers and sisters, you know. And so I think there's many, many kids who are single children who are going to be moving forwards. Have you looked at that at all, actually? Like, I'm
no,
just
I haven't
curious
looked
there. Because that could be next generation of something going on.
But they might get a lot of protective factors because they might end up with more attention, which could be a good thing.
Yep. The helicopter parents.
Yeah, well, the helicopter might be good in the long run.
maybe it is. But yeah, the resilience thing. So the resilience building is about having more roles around kids and having them in more roles so that if they miss one thing in their life, they've got other things going on.
It's essentially about extending those. And not only that, for example, doing trauma therapy with people, you need to get their stable factors in place first before you start.
Right.
Which is all of that part. They found that you shouldn't do trauma therapy, especially when people are dissociating, not only until they're stable, but till they're evenly going up, improving. They say that's the best place. So by helping people with all of the roles in their life, you're giving them, because with resilience training, which are, resilience is a protective factor, with the training on that, you're training people to do, you know, because people in a difficult situation, make sure they've got things to switch off with nice music.
Yeah.
And you arm them with all those things, and then, but also teaching them ways to self-regulate. Like breath work's become such a big thing in counselling and mindfulness because it's so effective. And they've tuned it in with neurobiology so that basically they've worked out if you start breathing and you have a longer breath out, it allows the neural energy to flow up better. And so where a situation comes where we're triggered, if you breathe, that creates a gap between you, the impulse, because you might be ready to react, but if you breathe, you don't, and it waits, and you breathe more, and it waits. And what's happening is the neural energy is going up, and it goes all the way up to the mid cortex and then moves around to the prefrontal cortex. And if you breathe, it'll take it to there. And that, what's amazing about that is that in yoga theory, they always talked about the kundalini. And, you know, some breath masters like Wim Hof, he does this movement that goes round to the front. And actually, that's what the neural energy is doing. So by breathing, the neural energy goes up and it goes around like that, exactly the same. And the prefrontal cortex is here where the third eye is, because Dan Siegel explains all that stuff. And that part of the brain, if you can get the thoughts up there, the midbrain, everybody's familiar with, what do you call those parts of your brain? The adrenal and the... the stress,
the amygdala one. And
all that.
Yeah.
So that midbrain thinking, by breathing, you can get away from that. And if you keep breathing and just waiting, for a start, the impulse doesn't occur, whatever you were going to say or do. Plus, when it starts getting all the way up to here, better thoughts come about. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's an amazing thing the thoughts that are, if you can get your neural energy up to here, the thoughts from there are things like empathetic thoughts, attuned communication, intuition. Hang on, I've got a list of them here because they're so amazing. Body regulation, somatic regulation, emotional balance, it modulates your fear response. Flexibility, that waiting gives flexibility of response, insight, empathy, morality, and intuition. So by getting to those types of thinking are really nice. And the reason that happens is because the prefrontal cortex touches all the other parts of the brain. It integrates everything. And it's just funny that they've proved neurobiologically that by breathing, it actually gets the thoughts up to there. And I experiment with it. So yeah. I was doing one thing. someone I knew was giving up an addiction and they were ferocious. They're in a bad mood. And I'm like, and I went to my room and I'm like, in my mind, I heard, bloody bitch. Do you know what I mean? I swore to myself and I went, oh, that's midbrain. And I just sat down and I started breathing. And then I think, oh, they're going through something. They're addicted. I can handle this. And there were like six thoughts that came in a row that were all that type of thinking. And then I was like able to calm down and like, why? And it was my reaction that was the problem. But by calming down, I could slow down and actually and then make that relationship, repair that relationship and make it positive again. And then be supportive through my friend who was going through their addiction.
Yeah.
Instead of being reactive. And that's one of the nicest things. And that's also integration. So you've got, same thing, you're differentiating all those ideas. So you're differentiating the breath, right? You're waiting, so you're separating that from the trigger. And then you're waiting, and then you wait for the thoughts, and the thoughts start talking to you when they finally get up there. And then once the more mindful breathing you do, the more thinking you do from there. I mean, it's a nice style of thinking.
Yeah. I'm wondering, sorry, my brain's been wondering whether or not that's connected to sacral rocking. So there's a technique where you lie down on, you know, on your back and you rock your sacrum, so your hips from side to side, because the sacrum's made up of several little bones, but at the tailbone, that's where the start of the dura is. So right. The dura is around your spinal cord, which comes up. It attaches in at C3. It attaches at the tip of the skull, the sphenoid, and the jaw. That's where the dura attaches. So when you're doing your sacral rocking, you're getting the kundalini going up your spine. It's bathing the brain so that the brain's getting all that lovely cerebrospinal fluid. Sure. And I suppose, and it's sort of a little yoga technique.
Anything that moves the body around like that, I mean, it's automatically going to create more flexibility.
Yeah.
Because
you're talking emotional flexibility, aren't you?
No, I mean physical. Because my yoga teacher taught me that she said that she goes, our bodies become stagnant because we stay in the one place all the time. We'll sit down like this. And she taught me to shake the body.
Yeah.
And especially the stomach even, because that just sits there. Yeah. And when you shake it, it moves it around because, you know, things sitting still create problems.
Yeah.
So all of the yogas have just moved. You know, there's I was reading a study that Bessel van der Kolk and a group of people did on using all the types of yoga, physical yoga and breath work and mindfulness. And the results they were getting, and they did a comparison with a really nice self-care group where a bunch of people got together, they exchanged ideas on self-care, they learned about self-care, they did modules, and they found that the people who did the yoga, it was one yoga a week and this was one thing a week, and the people in the self-care session, they were allowed to keep touch with each other, make friends, so they had all the social bonding. And the people who did the yoga, these were with treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder ladies.
Yeah.
And so they ended up getting better results with the yoga. Around the middle, it was the same, but the yoga lasted longer. And if they kept doing it, they started to get consistent results where they'd go into remission from post-traumatic stress disorder. And that was really amazing. And so now it's not only the mindfulness and the breathing, but the whole yoga system is starting to be, you know, fairly validated through the neurobiological doctors who are working on it.
Yeah.
But then the other thing is everything suits different people.
Yes.
And so some people things work with and some don't. And some people, sometimes yoga will bring up trauma for people. And so you need someone who knows what they're doing with it.
Yeah. You know, I was chatting to a woman about gratitude, and she sort of does, she's a counsellor, psychologist, and she always gets people to start with gratitude. And she said she starts her day with being grateful for the day coming forward, but then she thanks the universe for something she's grateful for that was a challenge the previous day.
Right.
Because she got through it, and what did she learn from it? Which, of course, is building her resilience as well.
She would have got a dopamine hit from it too.
Yeah, because, you know, once
you realize... Because there's the dopamine that you get from achieving goals.
Yeah, because, of course, we often get through our day and we achieve all sorts of things and we do get through all sorts of challenges, but we don't give ourselves any kudos for it because
right.
We just get to the end of the day and think, oh, what a shit day. But it wasn't a crap day. You might have, you know, oh, man, it was a crap day because you had 8 challenges you had to get through. But, hey, you got through 6 of them. Well, bloody done.
Yeah.
You know, it's like people don't give themselves kudos for actually achieving things.
Right. And they also leave things that make them feel good off their to-do list.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I sort of like your to-do list, you know, the idea of your to-do list. Right, what do I need to do? I need to play guitar, need to...
It's a role list.
Yeah.
And that's something you can experiment with. Do you know what I mean? You can...
So you help really? People work out their roles and their goals? Are the goals connected to the roles? I suppose.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
So each role has a goal, which is an ideal. So... And that's the way it works, because if you, like, for example, But just by looking at the role, by naming it, like it's a self-aware thing. Like
yes.
I'm a guitar player and
yes.
I'm this and I want to be that. Do you know what I mean? The positive number becomes an ideal and an ideal as well as a goal, but it's a goal.
Yeah.
But but ideals is a different way of put it, because ideal self.
Okay.
So we're looking at the idea of the ideal parts of ourselves. Do you know what I mean? And so it's like currently I'm a three. Ideally, I want to be that. And one reason for that is that studies have found that people's future selves, they believe are more real than their current self.
Right.
Isn't that so that is something.
So
that means
thinking...
No, they're thinking authenticity is in the future.
Right.
Which means that we have to go towards the future.
Huh. Okay.
But I found that very interesting. And so because the truth is progressive people are always going forward.
Right.
And so, of course, our future self will be better because we should be improving as our life goes on, not getting deteriorating.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Well, yes, that would be the plan.
And part of a healer is just helping people get back onto that track.
And once again, if people have no idea how to do that or what that even means, some people are just so entrenched in the matrix of their life, they've got no concept of what it actually means.
And people are so busy, they don't have time. And so it's nice to sit down with people and work it out with them.
Yes.
And it's like, and you end up with a really nice little list of all your roles mapped out, what their current thing is, what you'd like them to be in the future. And you've just got that thing. I found it was like there's a lot of goal setting type things, but you might have to write something. This is like such a small, reduced skill level. You just have to write one word. One word and two numbers, and that's you've filled in that little thing.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, and from that simple seed. So the other analogy I use is that our whole mapped out system, the way we interact in all the different roles and areas of our life, is like a garden. You know, so and you can look at each role you have as like a plant in your garden, and they're all, and you know, you give them attention and they grow.
Mm.
And they're each their own little story. But, you know, me, like in my case, being an artist is a classic one. Like I've been an artist for my whole life, and the fifth thing that it almost grows itself, but I have to focus on it. And if I don't do it, I get really like a bit miserable.
Yeah.
But it grows over a long period of time, and you know, are they healthy or are they not? You know, and because they become our stories, each role is a story.
Yeah.
And by working on them, then we can authentically tell that part of ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, because it's nice when you go, you know, hey, you said you achieved something. Isn't it nice when you go, I've been practicing guitar, look, I can do this now.
Yeah. So all
of that, it becomes a story.
Yeah. So all of that helps with people's self-control
mm-hmm.
and self-efficacy.
Right.
And resilience.
Mm-hmm. Agency.
Yeah, and it's working on those goals on a daily basis without them even really having to think too much about it.
Right, because system theory is differentiating each thing and then redoing the hierarchy and then reintegrate them in the new thing. And what it should do, because all system theory, whether it's in business or whatever, it's about reducing the complication.
Yes.
And in a well-integrated system, you've got smooth complexity.
Yeah.
And so whether you look at it in terms of, you know, like family systems, what happens with highly differentiated, hopeful people? They end up with a smooth consistency in communication. You know, things can just get smoother and smoother because on one side you've got rigidity, cutoffs, inflexibility, right? And on the other side you've got chaos, dysregulation, you know, anger and stuff. And so the dysregulation needs order and the rigidity and cutoffs need flexibility. And that's a good place to start. And then you integrate them into this nice way of doing things by, you know, just adjusting what you've got, differentiate it, and re-putting them in a new way and see how that goes.
Yeah. So when someone comes to see you, like, do you start with the roles or do you take a big history or something first?
Oh, no, it depends what everybody wants to do. I mean,
yeah, so it's quite different.
Well, counselling is quite prescribed. Like when you're doing counselling, you're using, you know, main
all
types
of your skill.
Well, you're using therapies, particularly like CBT or narrative therapy, or especially psychoeducation is really important. And what's the other one? And there's a couple of others. And so you do specific things with that. My roles, identity services, they're a separate thing. You could use them with, but mainly it's another thing. It's like a planning thing just to get started. And then you can do more work on them. But, you know, getting that first go, it's actually a really nice thing to have. Like, I'll show you what it looks like just for the record. I'll just put this up to the screen if it works.
Oh, yeah, right.
See, so you end up with a list of roles at all, just like that.
Yeah, nice.
And so, and with those, once you've got that list, you could start reflecting on them, because reflection is a big part.
Yeah.
And so just by looking at that and reflecting, you can take time out and you can look at it. And then after you've got that, you can also write. You know what I mean? You can write future plans with relations to those, with especially roles you've neglected. You might write about how you need to do these, and you might have trauma roles too that you might want to work on to do some therapy or some self. There's so much good self-help there at the moment out there too. There's so much on the internet that's available. So many good theorists, they write books, they have book launches, and you can get so much just on the internet and find your way to what sort of healing you want to get. So if you do come to a counsellor, you can really engage them.
Yeah, because I've been talking to people about that technique you mentioned to me about talking to that emotion that's been a challenge for you. So just say someone feels angry all the time and you sort of, and maybe I've got it wrong, but this is how I interpreted what you were chatting to me about. You sort of get into a space where you thank your body for that anger because the anger is there to protect you.
Oh, you mean parts work?
Yeah, parts work.
Parts work. So that's Richard Schwartz. That's really becoming you can't even get into training it for that at the moment. It's so popular. What that's doing, it's finding the internal voices and talking to them. It's really, I do it for self-care. But when you do that, you actually find a part of your body where, like, for example, I have this problem where I don't want to check my internet, my emails.
Yes.
And it's a resistance. And he says that find that part of your body and you start talking to it, like this voice, like the thing that's resistant. And you get there and you end up can have these communications with that part. And eventually you can, and you become friends with that part of your body. And they usually find themselves back in memories from under 10.
Yes.
They'll train back from when some event happened that set that on its path. And then after you get
to that. But it'd be like making friends with your anger and saying, okay, little body, thank you for protecting me. When was the first time you felt the need to protect me? That sort of thing?
That's definitely it. Yeah, so they're protector parts or manager parts, and they'll be like, and then except what they're doing is they're acting from that age. They're like over-empowered children, he calls them. Because they're not.
Right.
And
because
so
when they're born, that's what they're stuck with, the emotional intelligence at that age.
Right.
Right.
So this one of me scaring, being afraid of my emails, I went back to, you know, asking questions, and I got back to something that happened when I was 30, then 20, then 11, and then it was finally, then you ask them, how old do you think I am? You ask the part. That said 5, and then I got this image of me being 5 years old, this little kid who's really scared of going to school because the teachers would hit you with sticks every day.
Yeah.
And then you get to that and then what you do is you work out with that part. You go, look, you've done a really good job. Now I'll take over now, because there's the I part of it. In past work, there's the real, you find your real self, and you go, I'll take over that now. And then you tell them something like, I'd have to go through, but what would you like to do instead? Do you know what I mean? It's this thing that happens, and it's amazing clearing. But trauma therapists use that.
Yeah.
And except you can do it. He says it's a type of self-therapy too. So I just do it with myself because I've been in training.
Yeah, because I've been sort of integrating a fraction of it into my kinesiology balances a bit.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah, just sort of throwing it out there, and it's been really interesting.
Well, he was saying,
he was saying
to Bessel van der Kolk that he goes, I reckon if you do parts work, this part of the, you know, where the prefrontal cortex is, he goes, it often comes out on scans, just whited out with trauma survivors, and nothing's there. And he goes, I reckon parts work could make that come alive. And Bessel van der Kolk goes, prove it. And they ended up doing these physical studies, and I think the first one was arthritis.
Yeah.
And they got 50% of the study went into arthritis admission, remission from doing parts work, from talking to yourself. And so that was because they wanted to see if it affected physical things.
So creating schizophrenia works. Oh, just joking. You weren't saying something highly intelligent and witty, were you?
I was just saying that Richard Schwartz himself jokes about how it's like an organized schizophrenia.
Yeah, right.
And how incredible it is that they're getting physical outcomes with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredible too.
Yeah. Oh, look, there's so much connection. You sort of, there's great people out there, aren't there? Like
They just keep working out better stuff. And like, because I've just finished uni, I can't believe how good it was. It was like heaps better than I thought it would be. Just because the latest research is so good and they've worked so many things out, you know, and just in working with all types of things.
Yeah. Yep. Anything else you want to share before we wrap up?
No, I think that's good.
I think that's great.
How long have we been?
How can people contact you?
I can just put
a little thingamajig down the bottom, just your email and your...
Yeah, that for now. Because
doing Zoom calls with people?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I've just finished. So it's taken me a while to integrate what I've learned to because I've got a whole new story.
Yeah.
The nice thing about, you know, adding to a role is going outside is fun now because I've got a nice story.
Yeah. You know, and I sort of think of it as very similar to when you're learning kinesiology, because you sort of learn a technique and then you practice it on everyone you know, and then you learn another technique and you practice it on everyone you know, and at each level you're just learning new and new and new stuff, and it's just so cool.
The building's amazing, the knowledge
and the connections between everything as well. And it's not about working out what works the best, it's about working out what works for individual human beings.
That's right,
you know? And the more your intuition comes in with it, that will just get easier and easier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And plus, it's nothing to say, well, we can do this work, or this work. And you'll see people's eyes go towards one thing.
That's right. Like, and that's related to that idea.
People are attracted to things.
That idea we were talking about, where someone just sits with themselves and they think of that future picture, and if they like it, they're already moving towards it.
Yeah.
And it's good to have options for people.
Yes. Totally.
Because people like different things, and you know, you want to help people transform. You don't want anyone to be disappointed, huh?
Yeah, that's right. But that's the great thing about anything that we're doing to improve ourselves, as long as people are committed. And, you know, and that takes even just that very first step, getting to the end of that first step, going, well, that wasn't so bad. I didn't know what it was, but that wasn't so bad. You know, sometimes they're expecting trauma. They're expecting, because, you know, a lot of people expect trauma from counselling, you know, or they go on with their dukes up because they don't want to talk about their childhood, or they don't want to talk about this or that or something out. You know, so some people will be very defensive about what they will and won't share initially.
Well, a lot of people, if they go into their trauma, they'll get re-traumatised. It's not for everyone. You know, it's a courageous step to go back down to that stuff.
Yeah. No, and once again, it's the same as when I was chatting to someone this morning. She's very toxic. There's been some toxic, awful buildup in her body over the last year, and her body is not functioning now. And I was having a look at what this other nutritionist had prescribed her, and I was thinking, yeah, none of that's getting you detoxing. She's not releasing the toxins. So she, you know, I said, unfortunately, you know, you sort of have to get the detox pathways open.
Is she happy about that?
She will be. Yeah, her brain wasn't functioning. She's been in so much pain for that.
But that's like they say with trauma therapy, you want to get stabilization first.
Yeah, and that's what I love about this. Yeah.
And by being aware of all the positive factors explicitly through self-awareness of the actual person, that because Jung said the individual equation is paramount. Do you know what I mean? Working out what the, and so my idea, because Jung worked it out in types, and I thought, well, that's good. And you know, Richard Schwartz does parts, but roles, they use roles in business. That's why I use them, because they're more of a verb thing. A role has got many, because in a business, say, you'll have a role and different people will go into that at different times. So a role's more of a position that's stable and it's something that you can really work with. Because ultimately we're in the middle of a story. And so, you know, we're multi-role beings because we're also multi-storied beings. And those are all woven together beautifully. And if we can get them and differentiate so that they all work together well, you'll end up with a smooth flowing system. Because that's just the natural effect of good differentiation and integration theory. Because whether you use that in business, because I used to work as a designer and my first templates were working out how to do that, because in business identity, you work out the identity by looking at all the roles to see what happens in the business, and then you can work out what the message it is you need to put out to the community.
Yes.
And so I got the role thing first looking at business systems. I go, oh, they work like that. And I went, gee, I'm sure the identity works like that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks very much, David. Been great chatting with you. Nice long.
Oh, thank you, Madonna. It's been lovely, lovely to talk. And I've just finished. So it's a really good to get it down and get out there and start helping people.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck to you. Talk again soon.
All right. Thanks, Madonna. Okay. Love your work.
Cool. Love your work. Bye.
Okay. Bye.